Tonight, I have assembled a group of agitators.
Yes.
To ask you questions.
Yes.
You think you want to feel those questions tonight?
Feel? I taste the wine and listen to the questions.
Oh, are you drinking? We have enough wine for you, Father.
Thank you. So far, at least, I'm settled for the next 10 minutes.
You do know that I had a call the other day, and they said, we love Father Hess, but Father Hess should really not drink wine while he's giving his talks.
Ha, ha.
And I said, well, I think Father Hess will answer that question for you, why he does that. Rather than me object or do anything with it, I thought I would pose that question to you, because she said to me, why does he drink wine as he's speaking?
For the same reason that most of the other people out there, some of them are hypocrites, some of them like water, drink water in order to be able to continue to speak. I don't know about the madam in question who has objected to my drinking wine. She might be one of those God-gifted creatures that doesn't need liquid to go on speaking. In that case, she should kneel down and offer up a donation at the local church and light a candle in gratitude for being able to speak without liquid. Usually, when you continue speaking, you get a dry mouth. So you have to sort of substitute with liquid. And I choose the very liquid that Christ himself drank, that Christ made. He was a winemaker, you know, because... But a miraculous winemaker, not like my esteemed winemakers in California and in other beautiful countries in this world. He was a miraculous winemaker. He drank wine, he made wine, and he turned wine into himself. He chose wine to become his substance, not root beer. Thank God. And apart from that... I should really quote a defender of the church. Pope Pius XI, in 1935, gave him the title Defender of the Church. Feast on wine, or fast on water, and your honor shall stand sure. God Almighty's son and daughter, he the valiant, she the pure. If an angel out of heaven brings you other things to drink, thank him for his kind attention. Go and pour them down the sink. Gilbert Keith Chesterton. And I drink to his memory because I firmly believe that he is a saint.
Yes. Hear, hear.
The first question. Anyone has the first question on Father?
I was going to follow up on that. Aren't there 7 references in the New Testament that tells you that you should drink? And the only religions that tell you not to are those that are of a Manichaean bent, the determinist religions, the Puritans, etc.
That's an excellent observation. It's, as a matter of fact, really Manichaean. To the very concept of calling a thing, res in Latin, bad in itself, is Manichaean. It's heretical. There cannot be a thing that is bad. There can only be intentions and actions that are bad. Because a thing, whatever exists, whatever, no matter what, including the devil, whatever exists, whatever is, cannot be bad as such, because it receives, necessarily so, its existence from the from God. There cannot be anything in existence without God giving it its existence. See, the point is, God is the absolute simple being. In the strictly proper sense of the word, God does not exist, because in God there is no ex. See what I mean? There is no coming from. God doesn't come from. He is. We, in our complicated minds, we say he was, he is, and he will be, in order to be able to grasp an ever so tiny spark of this, not infinite, of this absolute simplicity. But existence as such, to call existence as such bad, is blasphemy. This table wouldn't be without God. the devil wouldn't be without God. What's bad about the devil then? Well, of course, his intentions and his actions. He said no to God. He couldn't possibly, in his incredible intelligence, which is intuitus, not with us, like with us, what do you call it, a sequence of thoughts that doesn't exist in an angel. An angel sees the truth, grasps it, in the very same instant he sees a thing. With such an intelligence, the devil couldn't possibly ever think for one split second that he could be like God. No. He wanted to be what he is because of himself. He didn't want to say, I will serve you. He didn't want to say, thank you. That's the point. And that is bad. It's a bad intention and a bad action. The existence of the devil is good. Not the way he is, but the fact that he is. And all the church fathers agree with me on this point. So I'm in good company. There is no such thing as a bad thing. Therefore, to say wine is bad is extremely stupid. It's blasphemous. To say wine is bad for you is at least a very proud statement, because you assume you could tell me what's good for me. How dare you? Are you the authority? You my confessor? You my spiritual director? Well, my friend, you didn't say that. I know. I'm just explaining. So to say that wine drinking is bad is a hypocritical statement, and at the same time, it means that you write up an 11th or 12th or 13th commandment. That means you put yourself in the position of God. This is what the devil wanted. He knew he could not ever be anything like God, but he wanted to be in his position. He preferred to be the first in hell rather than the second in heaven. I prefer to enter heaven, and if it's as the last human being ever, and to participate in eternal wine drinking, and look at the souls in hell who hated wine on earth and will hate it forever.
Father, you mentioned about wishing G.K. Chesterton was a saint, that he should be a saint. Speaking of saints...
In a way, yes. Yeah. I firmly believe he's a saint. I pray for his intercession. I don't say masses for him. He was a defender of the church.
This past Sunday, October 6, 2002... Pope John Paul II canonized a man named Jose Maria Escriva. A lot of Catholics raised their eyebrows at that. Wondering if this man should have been canonized a saint, and if he has been canonized a saint, are we as Catholics obliged to believe that he is a saint? And does this Pope have the authority to make this man a saint when maybe there's some things about him are questionable, that maybe more time should have been taken before he has been canonized as a saint?
Yes, that's a very good question, for the simple reason that I gave a conference on this subject yesterday. I will give you a short and therefore insufficient answer.
Okay.
In the conference that I gave yesterday, you will be able to see, which is available, you will be able to see the reasons. Now, first of all, I have to answer like the typical Jesuit. You know, the old joke about Jesuits, the guy comes up to a Jesuit and says, hi, Father, you Jesuit? Yes. Is it true that the Jesuit always answers a question with a question? Who told you that? So I have no choice but to say yes and no. Okay. Are you obliged to believe that he is a saint? Yes and no. I will only give you the most probable of all answers. Don't ever say that this is the answer, because I didn't say so. I'll give you the most probable of all answers. By definition, canonization means this man's soul is in heaven, period. That's in the form of canonization, in the liturgical form of canonization. There cannot be even the slightest doubt whatsoever about that. The form of canonization says this man is in heaven. Some of the worst sinners in the world were converted at their deathbed, received the sacraments, and if one of the sacraments they receive with an act of contrition is extreme unction, Then they get a plenary indulgence, and they're in heaven at the very same split second they die. If they don't commit the sin between, you know what I mean. But this I hope I don't have to explain. So, if the papal statement is that that founder of the Opus Dei, who was a liar and a cheat, is in heaven, then I have no problems with this. I'm not a liar and a cheat, but I commit other sins, and I hope to go to heaven.
Right.
So it would be theoretically possible to consider that one day some crazy, absolutely lunatic pope would say Father Hess is a saint. I say crazy and lunatic. Why? As far as the... and that's a sententia certa. That means we have certitude. It's not a dogma. We have certitude in the church that the canonizations are infallible. But the infallibility cannot extend beyond the mere statement, this man is in heaven. So when somebody like John Paul II canonizes somebody like the founder of the Opus Dei, I do not have an immediate problem with the idea that this man has been saved through the mercy of God, because we're all saved through the mercy of God. And we are all sinners. I have a problem with his act. I have no problem with, if I was asked and said, is it possible that this man is in heaven? I would say, sure, it's possible. Of course it's possible. How would I know? I have a problem with the fact that he did it. Because this is not an act of the church in the sense that it's against church tradition. It's against church tradition to pronounce an infallible statement about not being in heaven, or that's impossible, or about being in heaven with somebody who led such a miserable example of a Christian life. That's the point I'm making. He might as well be in heaven, in which case we don't have to discuss the question if he's pope or not, if canonization is infallible or not, if José María Escriba de Balaguer, that's not even his name, is in heaven or not. But we definitely have absolutely no doubt about the fact that this man should have never been considered for canonization, let alone be beatified and canonized. The church doesn't do things like that. I mean, not in the sense of sacramental intention. Careful. The church, the purpose of canonization is to propose an example to the faithful. That man is no example. The purpose is to propose an example. But then, I mean, of course, what do you expect from a pope who kisses the Quran in public?
Were you invited to St. Jude's to say the Mass and speak to the people at St. Jude's?
On the contrary.
He was disinvited.
I was disinvited. Thank you.
No, Father, what I think the question should be that they try at the chapel of St. Pius X to have you say Mass there, and also, I'm going to be in trouble now, I was trying to give that to you, and also to have a little conference there and use their facilities, so we have a lot of people there, and they said, no way.
Well,
now, is there a problem with you and the Society of Pius X?
Not as far as I'm concerned, because in Europe, I publicly work for the Society of St. Pius X. I've done translations for them. I have recorded the sermons, conferences, and decrees of Archbishop Lefebvre on tape with my voice. So when in the German seminary of the Society of St. Pius X, they listened to the German translation of what Lefebvre said, whom I believe a saint, Archbishop Lefebvre. When they listen to his sermons, they hear my voice. That makes it pretty obvious that I'm not exactly on bad terms with the Society of St. Pius X in Europe. And I usually give conferences for them in several priories in Europe. And I found a somewhat hostile attitude on the part of the American district of the Society of St. Pius X. I'm not a prophet, so I cannot look into the interior of human beings, and I have no explanation for it. But it's a very old experience in the church that sometimes the ones who defend you most are your greatest enemies. So I can live with it because God will be my judge, not the district superior of the Society of St. Pius X in the United States. And I have to justify my actions, my words, and my deeds in front of my confessor and my spiritual director. And by the way, my spiritual director is a priest of the Society of St. Pius X. He happens to be of German nationality, and he's also a good friend of mine. And he's one of the most intelligent, if not the most intelligent, priest I've ever met. He's also my best friend in the priesthood ever. And so I can only say one thing. I love the Society of St. Pius X. I will defend it until I die. That doesn't mean I will defend each single member.
If one were suddenly dying.
If one were suddenly dying.
Stay in the hospital.
Stay in the hospital, yeah.
And you couldn't get a priest.
You couldn't get a priest, yes,
would
which is
call
quite common.
A local priest?
Difficult question for the simple reason. You forced me to be a Jesuit again. Yes and no. Depends how firm you are. You see, if I have absolutely nobody to go to for confession, and of course confession is a little bit better than just the usual act of contrition, if you know what I mean. Do I have to explain that?
No.
Okay, thank you. So, confession, of course, is a lot more than just an act of contrition. I guess my practical mind would say you chance it. But that's only true if there's no danger that this man, whether priest or not, whether heretic or not, could get you off the track in your last moments.
Oh.
So, if you're firm in your faith, and if you know that you are actually risking to invite a heretic to accompany you in your last moments, and you know that you will not accept any of his objections to church doctrine and church tradition, then I would say, just for a simple practical reason, I would chance it. Like, if my car breaks down on the highway, or let's say I run out of fuel on the highway, and, well, this, I'm not talking about a civilized country like the United States where you grab your phone or you will have somebody like in Los Angeles. You'll have somebody passing every half hour to fill you up with gas. Says a lot about Californians. But you will have automatically every half hour somebody passes on the highway to fill you up. Now, let's say you're down there somewhere in Nevada or somewhere in the middle of nowhere in Arizona or Wyoming, and you run out of gas, and the next gas station says diesel only. You will possibly not succeed, but if you don't know enough about engines, you might as well try. So this is what I'm saying. There is two aspects. There is the question of the... hey, wait a second. I don't have a driver's license. I'm not supposed to know these things. I can drive streetcars. So the point is, as long as you are certain that your faith is not in danger at the very last and therefore most important moment in your life, I will chance it. Maybe some people will now say Father Hess is an indifferentist. But I'm not. I mean, you're talking about despair. You're about to die and there's no Catholic priest available. Now, the church, this is one of the reasons why the church has allowed all priests, excommunicated priests included, to give the sacraments in case of what is called periculum mortis. In articulo mortis. When you're about to die. When you're about to die, you could ask to confess to an excommunicated priest. Usually in the church there's a principle. You do not play with the sacraments. But the church's ruling on the merciful ruling on the extremely generous conditions in articulo mortis would certainly enable you to approach somebody who otherwise he would have never been able to approach. If I'm about to die in Russia and I can't get a Catholic priest, I'd be happy to have a Russian Orthodox to hear my confession. The church has always recognized the validity of the sacraments, all seven sacraments, in the Russian Orthodox Church. This is not a recommendation to go there. I'm strictly answering your question. You're about to die, and you cannot find a Catholic priest.
Okay. would the Vatican given by a Novus Ordo priest, would it be valid?
I'm not talking about, there's a difference. I'm not talking about the Viaticum. The Viaticum is not necessary. Necessary is confession alone. Necessary. And that's not even necessary in the sense of being able to die with an act of contrition. But confession is a lot more than just an act of contrition. And very highly recommendable would be extreme unction. I'm not talking about the Viaticum. As far as the Viaticum is concerned, that means Holy Communion, you have to respect what Blessed Innocent the 11th said. That's Indenzing a Schönmetzer 2101, where Blessed Innocent the 11th says, in case of doubt, you are not allowed to approach doubtful sacraments. And as far as the Viaticum is concerned, now, what happens today, I can tell you about a military chaplain in Austria who thought that if he put unconsecrated hosts together with consecrated hosts into the tabernacle, they would be consecrated. This is what we call the consecratio per tactum, or the consecratio per contactum.
So,
what?
By touch.
you have a consecrated host, you touch an unconsecrated host, and bing! Just like with the Midas, you know? Everything Midas touched turned into gold. So you have to face the fact that we are confronted with priests who are so absolutely idiotic. This man is not a deliberate heretic. He's just an idiot. So we're confronted with priests who are so totally, absolutely, incredibly idiotic that they really think if the housekeeper, that's what he said, if the housekeeper, before going to bed at night, checks the church, checks the tabernacle, and says, there's not enough consecrated hosts in here, I better add some, and add some hosts to it, they will be consecrated. Now once you get to that point, you will understand what I say. When you're in the hospital and you're about to die, try your best with confession, but refuse communion if you don't know what's going on. That would be according to the spirit of the church, because, I mean, I'm only quoting Innocent the 11th. And if you don't believe me, check 2101 of Denzinger and then tell me why I was wrong and I will correct myself publicly. I'm just saying this is the way I see it because of a logical consequence, the way the church are always... judged cases like that. See, Hans Küng is a heretic, public heretic. So he publicly is not a Catholic priest. But if I was about to die on a German highway, and believe me, I would, even if I'm about to die, I'd still recognize that man, Hans Küng. I'd ask him to hear my confession. Definitely. But I'm not going to ask him to pick up communion for me and give it to me or to celebrate Mass for me. I'll just say, please hear my confession. If he says no, I will say, okay, you will be called in for whatever I would have had to confess now. But if he says, ja, warum nicht? Ich bin gerne bereit, Ihre Beichte zu hören auf Switzerdeutsch. And I'm certainly going to confess to him because I have no alternative. In articulo mortis, you may chance it. But not with our Lord himself. The church has always excluded this. As far as the safety of the Holy Eucharist is concerned, there is no mercy. Because that would be contradictory. You cannot celebrate Mass out of mercy. You cannot distribute communion out of mercy. You cannot deal with the sacred species out of mercy. But confession? Yeah.
Father, I have a...
sorry, that was one okay. Before you, John.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Otto.
And I had you the first time in Delaware some many years ago. You talked about...
Otto, step aside. I'm not getting light here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We are enlightened.
Take your light away.
Yeah, thank you.
When I had you in Delaware some many years ago, you explained heretic. Is Pope John Paul II a heretic or not? And I bought the tape, I wanted to exactly hear exactly what you said, but unfortunately that part of the tape was cut out. They said it was a technical difficulty.
I can explain that very easily. The question was if John Paul II is a heretic or not. First, I must say that unlike the Saint John Maria Vianney, the Curé d'Ars, I do not have the gratia gratis data, the special given grace of seeing into the soul of a man. So I have absolutely no way to prove that there would be a possibility of accusing John Paul II of the sin of heresy. It's not my purpose either. I'm not interested, frankly. He pronounced dozens of heresies. That's a fact. He pronounced dozens of heresies. I give you one example. One is in that case enough. On January 11th, 1989, John Paul II said that the line in the Creed, and Christ descended to hell, is to be understood in a metaphorical sense. That's erroneous against Sententia Certa. Because our Lord's body was laid in the grave, that's heresy against the dogmatic definition of the Fourth Lateran Council. And he received, at the moment of his death on the cross, he received the beatific vision. That's erroneous against Sententia Certa of the Church. You can check that in Ludwig Ott. There's at least one of the three statements, and this is in one paragraph. It's quite amazing. He really deserves to be mentioned in the Guinness Book of Records as a heretic. One of the three is definite heresy because the council, the Fourth Lateran Council, explicitly says that the line of the Creed, he descended to hell, means that his soul descended to hell because the body was laid in the grave. John Paul II says it means that his body was laid in the grave while his soul received the beatific vision. That's in direct contradiction to the dogmatic statement of Lateran IV. There are several others. He pronounces heresy. But the old question, if when does it happen that the Pope loses his papacy, is first of all, has never been answered, not even in a Sententia Certa. It has never been defined. But most theologians say he would have to persist in his heresy. And then again, who is going to judge that he persists in his heresy? Saint Antonine of Florence says only the College of Bishops could judge that. I am not the College of Bishops, but I have to prove what I say. If I say that John Paul II pronounced a heresy and I don't give proof, then I'm in mortal sin against the Eighth Commandment. That's as simple as it is. If I say that the Pope is not, that John Paul II is not the Pope, then I have to prove my statement. He doesn't have to prove that he's Pope. That's granted. I have to prove it. This is the whole thing. And this is, by the way, also what many of the theologians have stated. They said, yes, of course, under certain circumstances, the Pope would lose his office. But then who is competent to judge? Canon 333 in the new Code of Canon Law, which is a literal copy in that case of the old Code of Canon Law, says the Pope can prima sedes anemini judicatur. The first see, which is the papal chair, will not be judged by anybody. But Innocent III, whom I venerate very much, Innocent III gave a beautiful answer to that. And he really should be sort of, the popes should really have that quotation on their bedroom walls. Because Innocent III said, reminding his successors in the papacy, don't ever think that because you cannot be judged by God, don't ever think that because you cannot be judged by men, that that is a sort of relief to you. The less a man is judged by men, the more he will be judged by God. I leave that judgment to God. I leave it to a future bishop's college, the present bishop of college, present college of bishops, a bunch of heretics. But so I leave it to a future college of bishops. I'm not going to be the one to judge that. I have different problems.
I have entirely different problems to deal with. It is not my competence and not my zeal and interest to decide if we have a pope or not, because it's of no relevance whatsoever. The election to the papacy is a jurisdictional act of the church. That's definite. Let's say, like some people say, we don't have a pope since 1958. Some people say we don't have a pope since 1963. Some people say we don't have a pope since 1965. Others say we don't have a pope since 1978. Then they say we don't have a pope since 1986, Assisi. Then they say we don't have a pope since... Come on! You're only adding to the confusion out there. That's not the way to deal with matters in the church, and it's not a serious way. It's not an honest way either. I'm not talking about personal honesty, God forbid. But I'm saying that's not the way to deal with things. Because it's of no importance. I mean, who's going to listen to the present pope anyway? The liberals don't listen to him because he's too conservative. The Opus Dei doesn't listen to him because it's more powerful than the pope anyway. The Jewish masonry, the B'nai B'rith, the Brothers of the Covenant, are not going to listen to the pope because they tell the pope what to do anyway. That's what Cardinal Chappi said on his deathbed. I'm quoting Cardinal Chappi. Don't sue me for that. And, I mean, they're not listening to the pope anyway. The liberals don't listen because he's too conservative. We cannot listen because we know he's wrong. So who cares? Let's say that we have not had a pope since 1958. What then at the next papal election? Nothing. Same thing. Read Canon 144 of the New Code of Canon Law, which you can find in the exact same version in the Old Code of Canon Law. I just don't remember the number right now. In the case of In the case of doubt about fact or law, the Church will supply jurisdiction in the external and internal forum. So let's say the present pope dies right now, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tomorrow, they'll state his death. A few days later, they call up the new conclave. They call all the cardinals in the world, say, come to Rome, we need a new pope. All the cardinals under 80. These cardinals, if we didn't have a pope since 1958, none of these cardinals is a pope. What's the matter with me? If we didn't have a pope since 1958, none of these cardinals is a cardinal. But they all think they're cardinals. They're all firmly convinced that they are cardinals. That's error. And if you look it up in the Code of Canon Law, you will see that in such a case, the Church supplies jurisdiction. They do not know that they are not cardinals. They are firmly convinced that they are cardinals. You talk about error of fact. You talk about error of law. The Church supplies jurisdiction. They will validly elect. Now, you might quote against that the old cum ex apostolatus officio of Paul the Fourth. A short biography of Paul IV would be sufficient to convince you that he was a maniac. Leo XIII thought the exact same way and explicitly undid that bull. And Pius X, in his new laws about papal election, his new laws about conclave, didn't mention anything of that. What? In Cum Ex Apostolatus Officio, Paul IV says, any cardinal who is a heretic or who was a heretic cannot be validly elected to the papacy. That's nonsense. As if the church would not recognize conversions. That means the Cardinal Newman, who was a heretic, and then became a Catholic and a cardinal of the Holy Roman Church, could not be validly elected. Or did he mean, Paul IV, that he would have had to be a heretic as a cardinal? That means that once you're a cardinal and you become a heretic, you cannot convert anymore? The thing doesn't make sense. And this is not my opinion, but the opinion of every single pope who reformed the law of papal election ever since Paul IV. And none of them has ever quoted Paul IV again on that point. This is not the first time of a contradiction in church history. The so-called theory of the double sword, the double authority, that the pope has the spiritual authority and the emperor has the profane authority, which was pronounced almost like a dogma by Boniface VIII, was thoroughly contradicted by Leo XIII. And the same happened with that funny Cum ex apostolatus officio by Paul IV. This was the firm conviction of Leo XIII. It was the one of Pius X. Then Pius XI again made a reform on the election of popes. So did Pius XII, so did John XXIII, so did Paul VI, so did John Paul II. These are things that are infinitely less important, not criticizing your question, please. But these are things that are infinitely less important than the question I asked before about what do I do when I die. You understand what I'm saying? Not criticizing your question. I'm very grateful for your question because these are things that have to be explained.
Father, we had a discussion on the way back today and you brought something up I think that the public should know. We spoke about Malachi Martin.
He was a friend of mine.
Yes, and I certainly worked with him also. We were going to do a video because he felt that the real terms of La Salette were never given.
True.
And you indicated something to me. Can we expound that just a little bit?
I know one line, not more than that. I know there's one line in the message of La Salette, and I have the confirmation about that via telephone. It might have been Malachi Martin, you see, who told me that, because we actually had several talks on the telephone. And there's one line that I know of, in the message of La Salette that has been censored universally. I cannot, in good conscience, say who was the one who censored it. I cannot say it was the Pope or the Cardinals. I believe it was a Pope. And again, I do not know which one. So let's leave that question. The line that was censored was that Our Lady said that in the coming century or the 20th century, that I don't remember, I remember literally the quotation, there will be deux papes vermoulus, en français. Two worm-ridden popes. Deux papes vermoulus. You speak French? Ah, bien. Deux papes vermoulus. Two worm-ridden popes. Your next question should be, who were those two worm-ridden popes? We have such a great choice. I positively, in all justice, I positively exclude John Paul I. Positively. One of my best friends in all the 15 years that I spent in Rome was Cardinal Pericle Felici, who was one of the closest friends that Albino Luciani, John Paul I, ever had. John Paul I was certainly not an Orthodox Catholic. No way. John Paul I made quite a few statements, including a very interesting fictional correspondence with a Satanist author of the 19th century, which is quite a puzzlement to those who know that man. I'm talking about Bossuet. John Paul II is certainly not what you would call a pape vermoulu, a worm-ridden pope. Because when you study the history of the church, and I'm not talking again about that poor, poor, poor Pope Liberius, who is always used as the scapegoat for all accusations against the church. I'm talking about people like the above-mentioned Paul IV, who was a paranoid maniac. When you go into the close history of Pope Paul IV, the way he treated cardinals, like he had them arrested without explaining to them why they were arrested. He would call an English cardinal, this is a fact, he would call an English cardinal into his audience. It means that English cardinal was expecting to face the Pope and say, "Hi, your holiness." And instead, two doors were opened. He was let into a huge hall. There the English cardinal stood and didn't know what to do. Bang! The doors shut behind him. Another two doors opened. Two Swiss guards arrived and arrested him. He asked, what's the matter? What's happening to me? Oh, we don't know. We've just been ordered to arrest you. The guy was in prison until Paul the Fourth... The guy, the cardinal. The cardinal was in prison until Paul the Fourth died. So we've had quite a few interesting specimens of the human race on the papal throne. And we have had Alexander the Sixth. Alexander the Sixth not only, which is something understandable to every man in the world, not only had children, but Alexander the Sixth had children while he was pope. Worse than that, he abused his papal authority to legitimize his daughter Lucretia. This is, I think, by far the worst. Hilaire Belloc says that the very moment that Alexander the Sixth legitimized his physical daughter, he was ridiculing the priesthood. Celibacy is not of the essence of priesthood, but it's intimately connected with priesthood. And he ridiculed this by legitimizing his own daughter. So we have had quite a few interesting characters in the papacy. And I don't see a reason why Our Lady would bother to call somebody like Luciani, Albino Luciani, John Paul I, Pape Vermoulu. Now, if we go into the Sede Vacantis theory, which is, again, I say, a very daring theory, because we are the ones who have the proof, who have to have the proof for it, and not the Pope. See, in the Church, you're not allowed to utter a suspicion unless you have at least some high probability or proof. And yet, there is hundreds of people running around, especially in this country, who say that we haven't had a Pope, and then they can't even decide since when. We haven't had. I received a letter a couple of years ago that told me that Pius X was not a pope. He was the anti-pope because he reformed the breviary. So, well, probably the next time I'm going to hear that Pope Linus was not a pope and Peter was the first and last pope. See, these are, it's all absurd because you have to have definite proof. Did Hillary Clinton cease to be president when she betrayed the Constitution? No. So the same thing is true here. But for argument's sake, let's say we have not had a pope since 1958. Who were the Pape Vermoulu? Pius XI, with his terrible mistake of instituting the Catholic Action, and Pius XII with changing Holy Week? Hey, see, there you are. That's one of the things that the Society of St. Pius X absolutely hates about Father Hess, that I dare to even utter the most remote criticism about Pope Pius XII. As if he was untouchable. He's not. Alexander the Sixth was as much Pope as Pius XII, and he was not untouchable. You shouldn't confuse dogma with judgment. And, so who are the Pape Vermoulu? Is it true what they say that in 1986 with Assisi, John Paul II ceased to be Pope, so the De Pape Vermoulu would either be John Paul II and Paul VI, or Paul VI and John the 23rd, or John the 23rd and Pius XII, or Pius XII and Pius the 11th? Hey, wait a second. Our Lady said there's going to be De Pape Vermoulu, two worm-ridden popes. My personal guess, don't say Father Hess dogmatically pronounces that this is such. My personal guess, is that the De Pape Vermoulu were Paul VI and John Paul II. But let's wait for the next one. I think we're in for a treat. Yes.
Father, this is a very broad question. Could you discuss phenomenology? And this is the philosophy, as I understand, of John Paul II.
Correct.
He's a phenomenologist.
Yes.
It was Dietrich von Hildebrand? Did he espouse this philosophy as well, the founder of...
I can't give you an answer about Dietrich von Hildebrand on this subject.
But he considered himself a phenomenologist, I think.
Did he?
I'm not sure.
Well, for some reason, some people might say, now there you go, Father Hess, look at that ignorant Father Hess. But for some reason, I've never bothered to read Dietrich von Hildebrand's writings. And I'm not saying you shouldn't read them. I have no idea. I can't pronounce a judgment on a book that I've never read. And as I have heard different opinions about. But phenomenology is, I think, since we don't want to elaborate on this, as you said, it's a broad subject.
Yes.
Since we don't want to elaborate on this for the next 3 hours, I'm gonna cut it short and oversimplify things, if that is permitted, and whether you like it or not, I'm going to oversimplify, period. The phenomenologist is a subjectivist. He sees things, for him the truth is, the way he sees things. Unlike what St. Thomas says, he's not going to correspond to what he actually sees, but what he sees has to correspond to his mind. It's not the adequatio rei et intellectus, the adequation of the thing and the intellect, but the thing has to adapt to his whatever turbid intellect he's got. So let's take one of my favorite instruments in this entire world, madam out there, whether you like it or not, a wine glass. Wouldn't this be, except for the waste of wine contained in it, a perfect ashtray? Every cigarette you dump in it goes psst, and there's no danger of fire. So let's say somebody who hates wine, like some people out there who criticize me for drinking it, somebody says, okay, I don't drink wine because I'm not a sinner like Father Hess. And I have absolutely no use for this here, so instead of pouring it out, I'm going to use it as an ashtray. Of course, these people would never smoke, which is an even greater vice. Oh, St. Pius X smoked almost all of his life. He still made it. And made it gloriously. 40 years after his death, he was a saint on the altar. Let's say this is an... I use this as an ashtray. Quite feasible. I smoke my cigar and I go, there you go. And then, is that an ashtray then? Is it? Or is it a wine glass that I use as an ashtray?
Via transcendencia.
Via transcendencia.
Both
right.
People.
So, the point is, if I bury that glass tomorrow at John Maffei's grotto out there, which hopefully will survive for centuries, and then 500 years from now they dig it up, they don't know what it is, they'll say, oh, what is it? Now, John Paul II would say this is an ashtray, because it's been used as an ashtray, lastly. You understand the perversity of thinking here? This is a wine glass. Whether I use it to listen on the wall, you can beautifully listen on walls with a wine glass, whether I use it to drink wine, whether I use it to drink Coke, whether I use it as an ashtray, or I use it to keep my paper clips on my desk. It is a wine glass used for paper clips, used for listening on the neighbor's wall. They don't do that. Or to drink Coke. It still is a wine glass. That's a fact. I explained this before. The form of things. It's a wine glass. This is a wine bottle. Does it mean you cannot fill it with gasoline? Of course not. But if you fill it with gasoline, it doesn't become a gas can. It's still a wine bottle that contains gasoline. You can fill it with soap. It's not a soap bottle. It's a wine bottle filled with soap. So be realistic. See, the point is, Chesterton said that the method of St. Thomas Aquinas was common sense. Common sense will tell you, everybody present here, faced with this empty, you would still say, if it's empty, give me that wine glass. I want to drink a little bit of water. See, this is the way you would say it. Please give me that wine glass. I want to drink a little bit of water. You don't have to drink wine out of it, but it's a wine glass. Thomistic philosophy will say it's a wine glass. John Paul II will say it is whatever you make it. Unfortunately, he does the same thing with the doctrine of the church.
Any other questions?
Earlier, Father, you mentioned something about the College of Bishops. Could you make some remarks about that?
College of Bishops.
Collegiality.
Collegiality. Collegiality, that's one of those things that you will find in Lumen Gentium. if I remember well, it's Lumen Gentium 20. Or 22. 20 is actually a beautiful description of the papal infallibility and the correct one, too. You see, even the devil is not capable of lying all the time. Lumen Gentium 22 establishes what is called the collegiality of bishops. And correspondingly, after Vatican II, you will find, be it in the Roman Catechism or in other books, a very interesting, non-existent, of course, distinction between the first authority, the highest authority in the Church. There is a highest authority of the Pope, and there's a highest authority of the College of Bishops. That's like, well, you know that the 20th century lasted from 1900 until 1999. The Pope believed it, at least. As much as the 20th century lasted from 1900 until 1999, as much there is a highest authority of the College of Bishops together with the highest authority of the Pope. What was the first collegial act of bishops? My friend pointed this out to me before we started the question and answer session, so I don't want to take the merit for this. But he told me, he said, the first collegial act of bishops is mentioned in the Gospel on Good Friday, and they all fled. As far as the present bishops are concerned, they should have stayed there. The collegiality of bishops is nothing but another attempt to turn the monarchical church into a voting club. Into a democracy. That's why in Pistoia, they wanted the people to elect bishops. That's fine with me as far as the first centuries is concerned. You want to know everything about her. You meet the girl of your life. She's a knockout. She's clever, at least. Later on, you might find out she's intelligent or stupid. But first of all, you know that she's beautiful and she's clever. And you're attracted. And you say, I'm really thinking I'm falling in love with this person. So you're starting to be interested. You listen to accounts of her own life that otherwise you would have never listened to. You would have said, okay, come on, I'm not interested. Bye. So when you love, then you're interested. So what I'm saying now, don't be overly curious. I'm not talking about finding out about God. All eternity will not be sufficient to find out about God, because the complicated human being will never be capable of understanding the absolute simplicity. We cannot say that often enough. So we have to be interested in God, not just love him, but because there's no love without interest. Interest not in the moral sense of thinking of yourself. There's no such thing as loving without interesting. What I'm saying is, people are breaking their heads. They are running after self-appointed visionaries and prophets who will tell you the last judgment is going to take place on March 1st, 2009. Maybe. What good is it to you if tomorrow one of those Philadelphia buses runs you over? A streetcar would never do that. What good is it to you? The point I'm making is, do you love God, or are you curious? Curiosity? No. I don't agree with that. Interest? Yes. Can you know enough about God? Never. Could you know enough about things in this world? Easily. Very easily. Interest yourself. First of all, what would happen if I was one of those maniac shootists? The anti-gun lobby loves that because they always use that. What if I got up, grabbed a machine gun, and shot all of you? Who of you would go to heaven? Who of you would go to purgatory? And who of you would go to hell? This is the only interesting question in life. The only interesting question in life. If you get up tomorrow morning, if God leaves you the time to get up tomorrow in the morning, if you don't die of a heart attack tonight in bed, If you get up tomorrow in the morning, you take your car, you drive to work, and you run over by a 40-ton truck, where will you go? As a practical person, which I always was, I will say, this is my first interest. Your first interest, however, should be, I love God, no matter what happens. No matter what I'm told about, no matter how much I'm in error, no matter how often I fall, no matter how often I fail, I love you. This is the only interesting thing. Not love myself, love you. As a great saint once said, typically for me, I forgot who. As a great saint once said, as long as the center of your life is not the internal you, the I may be lost. Thank you.